I've never, this is a weird way to start a conversation, but I've never dreaded an episode like this before. I don't, and it's actually a long simmering dread since I think a year ago, maybe a couple of years, that I've been thinking about like this exact episode. I didn't know I was gonna have it with you. Like, I didn't plan on, just sort of talking about this way. But like, ultimately, like, it was dread because to me, like, everything how we talk about this is so upside down and wrong. The like American assault on Iraq, from the fact that like we're sitting here now, and this is partially my own fault, but like also partially of like the media economy that I live in. Like, we're sitting here talking about the anniversary of something, like anniversary, this nice word. Oh, it's the anniversary, wedding anniversary. Like, oh, okay. It's like, oh, this is one of an invasion. Yes, when a massive empire, the world's largest empire, invaded and occupied a country that's a fraction of its size, that they'd also been starving for decades before that, and also been manipulating for decades longer. So it's like, yeah, this is not the word anniversary that we want to spend. And also, it's like, I try not to run my show again. I can't believe I'm making this about my show, but I think I have to. I need to create a path for myself to talk about this. But like, the fact that like we shouldn't tie our media production or content, whatever, or even our thinking about this stuff to the thing called the news cycle, TM. So the fact that like we have this thing in our Western minds, and I think this is like, I know this is like an Anglo UK thing, like an Anglophone thing of celebrating birthdays of stuff, supposedly. Like, this is the 10, and then for some reason 10 is important, or 5, 10, and then 20, and then 25, and then 30, and like it makes no sense as to like which one you celebrate. And so like this is part of the news cycle. It's like, oh, 25 years ago on this day, and there's like a whole hashtag OTD. There's like, these are media conventions. So, at the start of this, I have to say that like I hate the fact that like I'm participating in this kind of like pretty arbitrary point to like look back at something. But at the same time, this is going to be kicking off, like, I'm having a bunch of conversations around Iraq, and I hope to continue having them. I appreciate, Amir, you coming on the show and talking about this stuff and giving me your time, and you live this every day and looking at this stuff. So this is work. I'm making you do work for me. But I'm hoping that like in this conversation, I want to kind of figure out like, how do we talk about this crazy genocidal like scale of crimes that were committed against the Iraqi people, and done so in the name of giving them democracy? Like just the fact that that was the framing of it all, like, that's like, to me, just so crazy. Anyways, Amir, I should introduce you. You have been on the show before. People, longtime listeners will know you, Amir Taha. Thank you again. Please tell us a little bit. Just do a brief intro. What and your work. Because people, if they don't know you, they'll know what you bring to the table.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show. Thank you for the nice meta self-conscious self-awareness introduction you gave of the context that we are talking about this. Maybe just I'll briefly introduce myself. I'm Amir Taha. I am a PhD student at Amsterdam University. I am a historian of background. My current research is about mobilization against Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, with a specific focus on the 91 uprising, which was shortly after the other Iraq war in 91, after the Gulf War, where Iraqis took up arms to try to overthrow Saddam. And to research this, I do field work in Iraq. I look at relevant archives and try to sort of gain a historic perspective on this. On this year, this 91 year, especially from the perspective of Iraq, actually. Like, I don't think it's a coincidence that the end of the Cold War sort of ended with this war against Iraq as well back then and the Gulf. And I think they're interconnected to 2003, which, as you already mentioned, is now its 20th anniversary. In all honesty, like, I was dreading this as well. And I have some friends of mine, also Iraqis. Already 2, 3 months ago, we started like, oh, it's coming. This anniversary stuff is going to be all over the place. It still sort of defines, how we feel about ourselves, about the world, about, current political struggles where we live in Iraq and so on. And you just there is just something indescribable about this anniversary, about this 20th year since the 2000 war, because it's so generation defining, I'd say. So such a significant event that almost everything in Iraq goes, almost everything what we see in Iraq goes back to that moment. And I think, you know, it's funny, I yesterday or before yesterday, I read an article, I think it was in the Financial Times or something, saying like the Iraq war left the West unchanged. And I thought like, no, this is not true. The Iraq war not only changed Iraq, but it also changed Europe and the United States. I mean, the financial crisis, I mean, was directly related to the millions and billions of spendings on this war to transform this country into some sort of free market paradise. Costed the West so much money. It shows how global and how significant this war is, and it's sort of the way that media sort of talks about it is. And these are like several narratives that we have now about the 2000 war. As in, it's an historical event. It happened, and now something else is going on. Or it's like it was a mistake, but we moved on. There are different wars, so it's sort of repackaged as a lone standing event that is in the past that we now sort of have a post-war understanding of. Well, if you go in Iraq, I mean, this is a good point you made, that in the media machine that there is this whole anniversary thing. As far as I know, in Iraq, there won't be some sort of anniversary or some sort of remembrance of this 2000 war. People, it's going to be a very normal day in Iraq. Maybe some news programs will mention it, but there will be no like mass collective looking back, what did we do back in 2003 like you have here in the United States and Europe. And it says something about how this war meant different things for different groups, and which is of course normal, understandable, because Iraq is was like the target of Anglo-NATO imperialist interest, and the Iraq was of course the victim, and moreover, the Americans are still in Iraq. The invasion, the war is still not over. Iraq is still technically, I'd say, at war with the United States, despite the fact that in the public sphere in the West, this is framed differently. And it's also, I mean, looking at, back at it, like as a historian, you sort of see that how in 2003 Iraq was attacked because it was an insurgent country. It supported Al-Qaeda. It was causing instability in the Middle East and the world. It's an antagonistic country to the United States. But now, I mean, the sort of way that, you know, the American government talks about Iraq, it's still in an ambiguous way. And Iraq is at the same time a supposed ally, and at the same time, it's like seen as a rogue state, still as a rogue state. It could at any moment do things that could be counter to American interest, to stability, to peace, to whatever measuring evaluation system you want to use here. So Iraq is still gets striked from time to time. So you make you think, yeah, what was it for? It was meant to sort of rein in Iraq as a country that sort of was countering the American hegemony. And now it still is sort of. So how do you, how do you comprehend like these two decades of this and then where we are now, where there's no real significant policy change towards Iraq. Iraq is still being seen as a potential threat. So so the question is, how do you talk about this? And that's a very important question. How do you remember such a transformative historical event?
Thank you for that. There's also a difficult critical question, and this is because we're academics and we talk like this. This is why I keep sort of returning to this thing of like, how do you even process this? Because this thing that we enclose off that we call the Iraq War, not only is it absurd, because we're not talking about a war, we're talking about a few weeks of intense military combat and then a two-decade-long occupation that continues to this day, and a counterinsurgency war. And then there's another problem. People forget that there was a whole other war that happened after the Americans left, fought by America's allies, a group called ISIS, right? That at a certain point, that it wasn't even, that this was like a, what we talk about as the Iraq War is actually this two-phase or multi-phase unfolding catastrophe that sucked up like multiple generations of people and has since sort of like continued that. But then, first of all, you have to just, let's put that aside for a second. Let's zoom out a little bit, because you're also talking about the term war. And America doesn't just fight war militarily, it fights hybrid wars. And preceding the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, you had 10 years of genocidal economic war, which we use the euphemism of sanctions, right? These sanctions, supposed sanctions, were punishments for the crime of invading Kuwait. Saddam's crime, of course, obviously, was doing what Americans did, doing it Uncle Sam and not asking permission, right? Because we know Saddam, because then even talking about like that situation of like the first supposed Gulf War, which is itself this crazy term, because people draw Persian Gulf out of that, that becomes a whole thing. Yeah. And then like, where's the war when you're talking about this international alliance of massive countries assaulting one country? Yes, a country who had invaded and occupied the sovereignty of another, that story. But then this behavior that was then sanctioned a decade earlier when they did it to Iran. I mean, like the unfolding chaos of the post-80s Iraq is like such a mind-boggling, like, how do you look at that? It's like looking at Guernica and focusing on like one corner of it and like sitting there and being like, wow, that's really violent. And then there's this entire tapestry of pain and sorrow and destruction ultimately of this extremely modern, wealthy country that posed a threat to American hegemony when it wasn't a useful proxy war ally against Iran. Yeah. I mean, like that for me is in my amateur understanding of the entire thing. And I'm just a viewer, mind you. I'm not like a student of this stuff. Like I'm just, you know, I get this stuff secondhand through people like you and also just through my media consumption. So like I've seen over the years, I've seen snippets of like the last 20, 40 years of like chaos in Iraq just because of, say, Iranian war documentaries from the 80s, right? Yeah. I've seen a ton of those. That was like a phase I went through. And then I've seen footage from 2003, a ton of it too, shot mostly by Americans because they documented and proudly showcased and like archived their own crimes, like Brits, like other like French people. This is like a tradition of Western imperialists. They love documenting their crimes. So I've like watched a ton of that. I've also seen a ton of like, and also how I've seen them too over the years from like grainy videos on archive.org and like the live leak years, which was the chaos of the 2010s. And then we're talking, and then that's just like the early period of the Iraq stuff. Like then there were the flood of videos that came from the 2010 onwards, right? When the fight with Daesh really kicked off.
HD videos,
and you had this in, because people had cameras in their phones, right? So like there's a sudden spike. So like over the years, I feel like I've gotten this strange, and this is also has to do with the fact like the nature of what I do now is just like looking and bearing witness and just looking. Mm-hmm. Like it's as easy as that, because so much of what the media does for us is keeping us shielded from this stuff. So like over the years I've seen sort of snapshots of this chaos, of like Iraq's chaos, and it's just I shudder. Like I remember a story about like, I don't know, I was reading some memoir, I was reading the biography, this is so embarrassing to admit in this kind of episode, but I was reading the biography of Robin Williams for some reason. It was COVID, COVID lockdown. I went to dark places, we all did. So I was like really into biographies. And like I learned about this, that there was a story of this Baghdad lion, the lion at the Baghdad zoo. Like I even this, that was like a tragedy that but he was also amazing because he bit the US soldier's hands off.
Yeah.
Like, and then they shot him. I was like, what? Like even these stories and like the video of the American Marine throwing the puppy off the rocks. All of these things, I feel like, and of course the video of Saddam, which we did an interview about, like all of these snapshots are just grilled into my mind. And we're not even talking about the 2010s when actually horrific footage shot by proud Contras, Salafi Contras, which is what you should call them. We're not even talking about that insane footage that I've avoided mostly. I've managed to avoid it, and I want nothing to do with it because some of that stuff is so terrifying. And it like this is like I want to like actually cry because I've been like storing up. This is crazy. I can't believe this is turning into therapy for me. But like I've actually been storing up these secondhand traumatizing memories that like Iraqis somewhere in the world in the past suffered, like human or otherwise, you know, and like the landscapes, like the date palms set on fire. These are like little brief images in this entire archive of records that are available for anyone to watch, right? And yet we don't. And yet we really don't. We really don't talk about this war. We don't talk about what the Americans did to this country over the course of decades. It's been excised from our imagination. We didn't even talk about Abu Ghraib yet. Abu Ghraib! And that's the one we have pictures from. Imagine what crimes they committed by the people who were smart enough not to document them. Imagine those people's crimes. Like, again, that's not a question. I didn't ask you a question at all. I'm like, oh God, I'm losing my mind.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It was a long 20 years for Iraqis, of course, but also for people who were forced to see this, to be faced with this gruesome episode in our history. It's not an episode, but you get what I mean. And I distinctly remember at the time, you know, it was early 2000s. People began starting to have more internet access. People were starting to be on the internet more, and so on. Wherever you looked, Iraq was there. There were funny videos ridiculing the country. There were pictures everywhere, you know, reproducing the violence. There were forum internet discussions. It was in the movies. It was in the on television. It was in talk shows. It was just one. It's really defined culture globally. I mean, sometimes what I do when I like sort of a litmus test for me, when I find some sort of writer or author, I just type the name of the author and 2003 and see what the person said about Iraq back then. You can do this with literally everyone. Yeah. Literally everyone. Yeah. They had said something about Iraq most likely, and it sort of says how much impact this war is. But like, it's also something that I try to develop in my work. How, you know, this whole time, the 1980s up until now, this whole 40-year period, sort of a transitioning period from a time where you sort of had big government development programs and so on. They started to be dissolved at the beginning of the 80s, the rise of neoliberalism and so on. And I think Iraq and the rise of Saddam and then his fall and so on should be seen within this violent transition, in the sense that, like, when Saddam came to power, people sort of, you know, one part, of course, was him fighting against Iran, but another part was like union busting, privatizing the economy, freeing rich merchants from prisons, these sort of things, bringing in guest laborers from all over the world, investing immensely much in global media.
He cloaked himself in the flag of Palestine, gave money to martyrs' families.
Yes. But it's also like in the 1980s, like, there were also so many Western companies that came to Iraq at the time to just do infrastructural projects, to set up factories, to provide consultancy and these kind of things. I mean, living here more than once, I've come across these baby boomers who suddenly told me, yeah, I was in Iraq in the 80s, and then they were like some sort of car factory manager or something like that. And then they told, yeah, they, at the end of the 80s, we left, sort of. So it was this period where Saddam sort of, for a glimpse, represented the future, this sort of capitalist country being held in control by this authoritarian dictator who knew what he has to do with his workers and he's, you know, send them to war and these kind of things. And then the Gulf War happened, and the Iraq fell into an economic crisis right up until the first Gulf War. And like, as a grab for hegemony, he decided to invade and occupy Kuwait, and to sort of revive his economy, and sort of always the belief that the United States needed him. Saddam really thought that the United States, at the end of the day, wants him above any other alternative, even at the cost of Iraq, even at the cost of anything, actually. So when he invaded Iraq, Kuwait, he sort of did that with this belief also. And then, then the Gulf War, which is also, helped forget the Iran-Iraq War as well, because that was the Gulf War first. And then that sort of name was stolen by the, was stolen by the new Gulf War, which was in 91. This was a coalition larger than World War II against not only Saddam, but against all of Iraq. All of the infrastructure was destroyed. Countless civilians died. Country was totally reset to pre-modern condition. Water was out, electricity was out, and many more. But still, Saddam stayed in power, and then the sanctions happened. Still with sort of Saddam believing, they can try what they want. They can do whatever they want. They know that without me, they'll have the world overrun by Iran. So this belief sort of kept him sort of in denial up until 2003. That like until the last day, his main concern was some sort of uprising, some sort of internal uprising against him, and not the Americans actually invading the country. Yeah. And
he let them set up all their forces along their border. He just sat there, and then he went and crawled into a hole.
Yes.
That's how all powerful and intelligent this man was. And of course, this is the person that the CIA helped give to Iraq, essentially. Yeah. Basically give Iraq to. Because he got his start working as the CIA, working for the CIA.
Yeah, yeah, he had contacts with them, yeah.
He was an American ally until he wasn't. Like, this is the story of the modern Middle East. This is a story of like brutal compradors who work on behalf of the imperial interests until they die or are overthrown in revolution, hopefully.
Yeah.
But usually until they're pushed out. Like, and the story of Iraq going from like a treasured little like island of stability.
At the center of our world lies the Middle East, and at its very heart, the ancient land which is Iraq. Two great rivers span its length, the Tigris and Euphrates. In the plain, made rich and fertile by their waters, the earliest civilizations known to man were born. Out of this ancient heritage, the citizens of one of the world's youngest nations are building a new life and a modern state. Ageless Iraq is no longer a remote, isolated country. Today, she is a main junction linking the East and West. Her capital is Baghdad. A name that conjures up all the romance of Harun al-Rashid and the Arabian Nights of 1,000 years ago, when this was the fabulous capital of the Islamic world. The tempo of an age-old way of life contrasts with the swifter rhythm of the new. The 20th century has come to Baghdad. With steel and concrete, with shining cars and wide streets. But the people of Iraq hold on to the best of their old traditions. In the bazaars, you can see and hear them carrying on the art and exquisite craftsmanship that has been their pride for hundreds of years. 2,000 years before Christ, the world's first code of justice was laid down in the halls of Babylon. Today, in Baghdad, a modern police force upholds the laws of a sovereign state. Today, the streets of the city are alive with the bustle of a young people who are taking back from the West the means to a brighter future. And in their enjoyment of sport, the same is true. And now, in the 20th century, the sport of kings has come into its own in Baghdad. How the people love it. In Iraq, as in every land, the housewife's work is never done. For their husbands, the day's work over, there is time to sip a glass of tea and talk of what the future holds in store for them and their children. Today, the modern port of Basra is Iraq's waterway to the world. Ships laden with the goods of the new age sail out from the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean and the Far Orient. And the skies over Basra are thronged with the traffic of the air. And yet, within a few minutes' flying time of Basra, is a strangely different world. You're back in another age. Here, amid lakes and marshes, water has created a way of life all its own. A way of life well suited to these strange surroundings, and at the same time a living reminder of that remote past when men settled by these waters to found the first great cities known to man.
For Western, you know, like after Qasim, obviously,
yeah.
That it wasn't part, that it broke away largely from like the Arab alliance.
Yeah.
This is the dream of imperialists. Like this was their fantasy the entire time, of separating all of these big, energy-rich, large countries with large populations that could develop their own sovereignty, God forbid.
Yeah.
And it's important to knock them down. So sometimes you use them against each other, like they did in the 80s. They bribed Saddam, and it wasn't just Americans. Basically the entire Arab world joined Saddam in this insane invasion of Iraq that he could never have won, right? He could have never had been close to winning, but... And he was always on the back foot in the entire 8 years until he started using chemical weapons supplied to him by the Germans.
And the Netherlands.
Netherlands too, right? Like this is the rapacity of the West, the violent, evil nature of like the Western imperial machine. They will use you and then they will throw you away and then they will smash your country and then keep and loot the gold, rape and maim and murder the people, and keep the oil for themselves and divide up the country, and they call it democracy. This is, I cannot like shake this like dreadful feeling. But I think in some ways I was thinking about this earlier, and I realized that like because of my own anecdotal role in this history, which is to say, like I was protesting against it and loudly against it, and you know I was living in Canada, so our government didn't go along with it, sort of famously.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of joined quietly later. It joined the American alliance later, like a lot of other countries. But like, you know, like that, the fact, I feel like it was such an object study in like what democracy actually means. That millions of people, and not just around the world, but in the US specifically, cannot to say like, don't do this thing. And it just didn't matter. And in fact, all we really did, I realize now, was help recruit soldiers. Because in the end, they used 9/11 to gin up this insanely violent anti-Arab, chauvinist American, and Islamophobic discourse among the Chuds, of which there are many in the U.S. There are millions of potential Chuds across the class spectrum, middle class, lower class, upper class, happily. And they're all races, too. Different, you know, it's a panopticon of Chuds, or a panopticon. It's a Benetton ad of Chuds. So, like, they're happy to join in this orgy of violence that the U.S. was planning, not just for Iraq, but through its proxies across the region in this insanely violent regional war. So they did that with Afghanistan. They used 9/11 as an excuse. But Iraq, and ultimately we know from the famous memo, 7 countries in 5 years, that Iraq was one of the pillars or one of the stepping stones on the way to where real men go to Tehran, right? So that... Like they had softened up Iraq by that point, but the goal was to go to Tehran. And at one point in the mid-2000s, there were 500,000 U.S. troops surrounding Iran's borders. I mean, if you it'd be crazy thinking about it, but like this was the general goal in Iraq, this country of, what was it, 30 million?
Yeah.
Maybe less.
Back then, even less, yeah.
Yeah, less. Like it was just one footnote in that. But all of the hubbub and like all of the like resistance to it, which is to say, cultural resistance to it, really just helped the neocons recruit soldiers, because they actually did have a soldier problem. They didn't have enough soldiers at one point. Like the Rumsfeld was hated by the military elite. Like the U.S. military clearly wanted Iraq at the beginning, but then they realized that it wasn't going to be what they thought it was. I mean, we can get to that later, but ultimately, like the global view of this for just that phase of this insanely violent history is one of the U.S. military having this stockpile of resources that it needed to expel, and it picked a country that it would be a nice showcase for it.
Yeah.
And they ginned up a bunch of reasons to do it, and they sent their little neocon class as like the avant-garde to like sell it. And they had one comprador. It's interesting the way that compradorism has changed over then. Then they had literally one comprador, one guy, Ahmed Chalabi. I hope you're burning in hell and drinking piss every day in hell, Ahmed Chalabi. But they had one guy. Now they have armies of them. Women, men, gay people, straight people. It doesn't matter. They have whole armies of compradors now. That definitely multiplied. But
the anti-war movement is sort of gone now.
Yeah, but that's just like the first phase of the American bloodlust on Iraq, or at least phase 2000 to 2012, whatever.
Yeah.
Because then we still have the last 10 years, which was this insane fight with this proxy army of the West that just happens to only attack, never attack Israel, by the way, if we can mention that. A militant group that somehow doesn't attack Israel and only the enemies of America and civilians, of course, in the West as like nice, spectacular. And that's called Daesh. Because that's a whole other phase that was waged through, not just like, it wasn't waged through American-funded or American-approved, let's say, Contras, but it was also passively enacted through the insanely weak and feeble nature of the Iraqi military. There were so much money was spent, supposedly, building it up, right? Like, they set up this house of cards that would easily be kicked down by Daesh to the point where, at some point they had 60% of the country. Imagine having 60% of your country to pirate dragoon freaks. I mean, like, they had it. It was called the U.S., but these are different kinds. These are Salafi freaks. I don't know who's worse, actually. That's an interesting question. But, like, imagine having 60% of your country, like, under their control. I mean, it's unfathomable just that point of it. Of, like, was it 2015?
Yeah, 2014,
14, yeah. Like, that even to me is, like, how many episodes are we going to do on that, Amir? Like, how many, like, should we just start a podcast called the, like, Crimes of Against the Iraqi People podcast? And we just, like, show up and, like, cry to each other for, like, a year or something? Is that what we do to adequately cover this? Because I think, I don't see another way.
Yeah, that's liters of tears, I think. Well, maybe you address several points. I mean, first, I think, well, it's not a matter of I'd say, evil. It's like in the 1990s, there was a necessity. I think that's what, like, based on my readings and my understandings of history, there was a necessity to regime change Iraq, because if you remember the 1990s, shortly after, like, the whole triumphalism after the Cold War, many problems occurred, like all these wars that erupted, that the United States and the UN made worse in Yugoslavia, in several countries in Africa, North Africa as well, the Middle East, and so on. So you had that on the one hand, but you also had, like, this shift, this disinterest in globalization, what we used to call the anti-globalization movement at the time. I still remember, like, in the early 2000s, how they were ridiculized, but they were actually quite significant in the 1990s, about how post-Cold War world dominated by the dollar, especially oil, which had to be paid in the dollar at the time, was something that a lot of countries wanted to shift away from. And one of those countries was Iraq. And around 2000, Saddam Hussein tried to sell his oil in euros instead of dollars. He set up several contracts with France, with Russia, and so on, to sort of shift away from having the global economy being dominated by the dollar, which now, you know, begins to look more realistic than ever. But at the time, it was quite threatening language. And there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. China and even Japan and Germany were interested in this idea. And this was a direct threat to, like, a system based on the dollar currency that sort of relies on guaranteeing cheap oil for the United States allies. And Iraq was now threatening this system. And with it, the rest of the American hegemony might have been threatened. Sanctions didn't really work, because through this way, Saddam would have been selling 3 billion barrels of oil. So, you know, we'll get a lot of money from it. It would be back to the amount of oil income Iraq would have before 91, before the sanctions. So sanctions stopped working. What else was left over to do? And then, of course, 9/11 happened, and that accelerated. So one part, the reason of why the whole protesting and didn't work is because it's there were also structural reasons why the United States had to stop Saddam for its own interest. And then Saddam, of course, within because of his own incompetence, never understood that the United States was interested in getting rid of him. Like just I told you before, he believed that he was needed till the very end. I think even in court, he sort of believed that they might sort of let him go at the end under some sort of deal. So that's what's one part, I think, that's sort of missing a lot of these anniversaries, a lot of these looking back. It's still about, you know, the illegality. It was an illegal war. It was against international law. It was against democracy, you know. WMDs weren't there. I mean, if you look at it from a larger perspective of history, this is not what was, I think, what really pushed for this war. And evidence of this, is sort of which validates this perspective, which you now sort of see, is what Saddam back in 2000 tried to do is now sort of happening. The interest in doing trade in the dollar is only decreasing. China is now stepping up. Russia, in collaboration with China, is stepping up. Iran is also interested in this. And I think, especially Iraq now, that is because of its suffering, because of its of the fact that all its trade has to be done in dollars, and the fact that all its money is in Federal Reserve banks in New York, and so on. And the United States sort of actively trying to stop this and struggling against it and creating propaganda against it and so on, sort of validates this perspective looking back. It's like as if America bought some time to prevent this, and now its cards are running out, if you know what I mean.
No, I believe you absolutely. I feel that the post 9/11 wars are an empire that is sensing its own imminent decline, and it used all of its hoarded resources, like many multiple sort of insanely vast troves of material resources, wealth, to create this kind of military buildup for the sake of their own economy. And I feel that they decided that, yeah, like the world order isn't going to continue like this. We can't. There's other things that are headed our way that we are watching right now, quite remarkably happen, like as we speak.
Yeah.
Like really, it's crazy. Like we really live through this transition time. But like I feel that, you know, the U.S. elite and the imperial planners knew that this was coming. It was going to have peers. And even back then, it's crazy to think what Russia was like in that year of like 2003,
yeah,
versus what 20 years later, what role it plays in the world. I mean, there's a whole thing there. It's similar to the story of Saddam, is that, oh yeah, maybe we can work with the West. Maybe we can be partners. And then you realize what that means. It means, no, you're their vassals. And if they tell you to put your foot pedal to the metal and drive straight into a wall, you're going to do it with a smile on your face, or we're going to coup your ass and put in somebody who will, which is like the American way. It's gangsterism. Like, this is how America runs the world. And just to think of the two, like these two countries, your country and mine, and the divergence that they took in their modern histories of which way, you know, Asian men, Middle Eastern men, which way do you go west? Do you look west, or do you build up your sovereignty and use your natural resources to build up your country and like enrich your country and, you know, and create some kind of national defense? Or do you open yourself up to Western liberalism and everything that comes with that? Saddam thought he could have it both ways. He thought that he could ally with the West and do their bidding.
Yeah.
And he thought that, oh, then they'll let me. What will they do? He thought he was bigger than he was. He was more powerful. And he thought they wouldn't do anything about Kuwait. I mean, just the invasion of Kuwait alone is such an insanely myopic. And interestingly enough, one of the loudest opponents to it was Hafez al-Assad, you know, complete defender of Kuwaiti sovereignty, you know, because it really was an attack on sovereignty. It was a red line that Saddam crossed, and it was a red line that international imperialists are going to punish you for. And that was the interesting thing, is that there are certain things you can and can't do. And it's not like that. We think that way. We think that, oh, there are crimes that you can't commit as a state, that is.
Yeah.
Right? But it's like, no, you could commit them just against the right people.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If they're the right people, that's fine. You could gas Iranian soldiers, totally no problem. We'll give you the weapons to do it, bro. Like,
yeah.
we'll make money off of it. Like that's that, and then you know, but oh, you want to break in our little colony that we created, like that the little a little oil colony we created that's basically, you know, by all respects should be Iraq. I mean, in a sense, I'm thinking like Saddam, but like in a sense that like
Well, I
there's
didn't
no
expect you to
what
say
it,
this.
you know, I mean, in the sense that yeah, I'm an Iraqi Ba'athist nationalist. In the sense that like it could have well just easily fallen into Iraq if it was not for the intervention of the imperialists who decided to sort of
Yeah, there is
draw
a
up this
colonial
region.
history to it. Yes.
Yeah, it's just so Saddam decided one day he was going to be an anti-colonial crusader and invade Kuwait, and we all know how that worked out. But it's like, how incompetent was this man? But putting that aside, I think maybe because even though we have to tell these stories through him, in a sense, I also don't like this business of like fixating on him because this was the story of modern Iraq is the story of imperial interference from its creation by like by you know these European aristocrats in whatever Sykes-Picot to and I guess you could also pull it back too to like Ottoman times, but let's just pick it up from the Brits for laziness of this argument. But like from its creation to its temporary, very short-lived independence and sovereignty period under Qasim, and then the beginning of the dark times under this reign of compradors and elites and brutal freaks, you know, like who decided that, oh, it's going to be this way. And like, just and so it, even then, to go back to that original question of like, how do you talk about this? Maybe we, though, it is helpful to sort of maybe let's divide up the first half because we should get into it because there's people listening to this who weren't, who are like in their 20s, you know, who are maybe teenagers even, who like weren't around, who like didn't even get much of it because there was a kind of informal media ban after this intense recruitment period of like the so-called opposition and the build, they call it the build up to the Iraq War. Really, it was it's the these are like positive words, build up. You know, this was the hexing of this country that was done in the media, and then they turned their cameras off when it got kind of ugly, and they didn't, and they especially turned the cameras off now where you're seeing, you know, the birth defects of the children of Fallujah. You know, that's not something that's going to make the news, you know, here. You know, and if anything, they're going to shut that account down on Twitter. Everybody should follow it. It's hard to follow, but it's like, I mean, that's one example in a sea of sorrows that this country has been befallen. So I don't know. How do we, let's try a kind of narrative approach, a sort of temporal narrative approach, and begin with 9/11, I think, maybe because, or I don't know. How do we even do that?
Yeah, it's I mean, you make a point. It's sort of this extreme and narrow understanding of Iraq as Saddam is, of course, a very misleading provides a very misleading perspective, and it's typical of course, of, you know, standard history that focuses on the elites of the countries, you know, the quote unquote the great men and these kind of things. Well, Iraq, of course, is also a complex society with government institutions that interact in a dynamic way, and it's those interact globally with the world and so on. And then you have, of course, you know, history. You know, people have their own history, their own customs, beliefs, and so on. It was not all Saddam and, you know, and the rest of the world. And sort of in a way, you sort of reproduce the, you know, the old the Ba'athist myth about this guy who said, from well, I mean, Saddam was part of a elite coalition in Iraq that got split off at the beginning of the 90s. After the Iran-Iraq war, all those rich Iraqis who made a lot of money because, through the war economy, they were sort of done with Saddam, who brings to them sanctions and not more war adventures and these kind of things. And from there, this is sort of an under-researched aspect of this history. A lot of these former, let's say, elites in Iraq, they joined the opposition in the 90s. And then you have also, like, this is also interesting because there are also people, and Ahmed Chalabi is one example of this, part of the monarchical elite of Iraq, like really old families, you know, who left Iraq around the 60s and 70s, who in the 90s sort of.
Oh, was he from a notable family? I didn't know
He's
that.
from an
Oh, okay.
aristocratic monarchy family.
What's the fa- Is it called? Are they the
The
Chalabis? Is
Chalabis,
that like a
they were
family? Oh,
a
okay.
big aristocratic merchant family that had good ties with the pro-British king at the time. But not only them, many, like many family. I mean, the famous, what's her name? The the architect Hadid, Zaha Hadid. Yeah,
yeah.
Her family was also descends from a big important aristocratic family from under the monarchy and so on. And her brother Zaha Hadid wrote a book in the 90s, Democracy in Iraq or something like that. These were all like formal Iraqi colonial elites who became part of the opposition in the 90s. And then they sort of wanted to try to also get power during the occupation as well. But that sort of failed. Nobody knew who they were. Nobody were interesting. And some of them today have like Twitter accounts where they comment on Iraqi politics unironically. But but that's besides the point. Besides the point. So that shows how like the complexities of how Iraqi history is so layered and how this influenced also its sort of its politics. But I sort of lost train of thought here.
I was debating like how do we narrativize the war?
Yes. So what I wanted to emphasize Iraq was not only targeted. It was not only an object of war, but also the history of Iraq is also a history of struggle. It's also a history of constant mobilization, constant organizing, constant, you know, struggling for sovereignty, for representation, for prosperity, for justice. Iraq has a long tradition of political mobilization, party organizations. Like the amount of political activity that has taken place the past 100 years is uncountable, and it continues after 2003. The United States couldn't do everything after 2003. The United States was forced to give concessions to the, for example, they couldn't change the what they call law number 80, which was like the original oil nationalization law. They couldn't change that law, for example. A lot of protests in Iraq happened at the time, and there are many, many examples. So I think one way to, on the one hand, critically narrate this event is to look also from bottom up, to look also at the perspective of struggle. And that's when I was in Iraq, this also had people, some of them, they still see we've been struggling for 40, 50, especially the older generation. It was struggling 40, 50 years. Some of them became like apolitical, apathic and so on, but they still sort of believe that fighting for your country, fighting for your life is still part of their reality. And they sort of, they don't like, they, a lot of people, they didn't sort of cut it up neatly in these historical periods. You know, at first you have the pre-2003 Iraq and the post-2003 Iraq. A lot of people tended to talk in longer periods. You know, they say the United States is involved in Iraq for more than 50, 40 years, and they talk in a way. A lot of people in the interviews, they talked about this in that way. Didn't they, like, it also said like, yeah, when the Americans came in 2003, we already knew what we were dealing with. We already know this is not a liberation. And despite the fact that Iraqis at that time, you know, they were malnourished through the sanctions, they were disarmed and so on, there was still a popular consciousness, a popular awareness of politics, of what it is and what it means and so on. And I think, like, especially looking back at 2003, the current, I'd say, ideological struggle is defining the meaning of American intervention in Iraq. What was it? When did it start? How did it start? What are its continuities? When did it begin? Will it ever end? And these kind of things, because we can also write about 2003. It was a historical event. It happened, and now Iran has taken over or something like that. You see sometimes these sort of narratives. And I think, way to, narration is of course a way to do this, but also just documenting accurately what, from the perspective of the Iraqi people, what 2003 is about. And until now, there is no real historiography about the occupation. There is sort of, yeah, why did it happen? How did the United States involve itself? There was no real what happened in Iraq from a historical perspective. There's still no historical books, the American occupation of Iraq or something like that, that takes like a critical historiographical perspective on this on this matter. We're going too much in the direction of academia now, but maybe perhaps a short recap of what happened in 2003 might be at its place.
Yeah, let's just do a timeline.
Yeah, so when the United States came to Iraq in March 2003, the first phase was about military combat. This, you know, this was done over within 12 days or so. It didn't take a lot of time. And shortly after that, the occupation began. What the United States did at the time was to sort of transform Iraq from a sort of collectively minded society, you know, that had collective ideologies, to sort of a homo economicus, the liberal individual consumer who would thrive in a free market economy, would focus on his own home, on his family, and would not indulge himself in these grand ideologies like Ba'athism or Islam or Iraqi nationalism and these kind of things. So one part of this was, of course, the Ba'athification, but also the defunding of universities, of schools, rewriting the curriculum, and also repressing groups, individuals who sort of showed these sort of sentiments. And what I also want to say, like in the initial month or so, people began in Iraq, all over the country, they began to self-organize themselves into councils, into local committees. They held local elections, like all on their own. But this was interpreted as insurgency by the Americans. So
They wanted democracy, and then they...
Yeah, then they got
that's
it.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't know this aspect of it, honestly. That's very interesting.
If you look at reports of around the beginning of March, April 2003, you'd see some of this mentioned. But also, people told me this in interviews as well, that initially they sort of, yeah, I mean, okay, the current government seemed to be gone. Everyone sort of knew each other in their own district or in their town or their village. They knew who sort of were the local elites, and they set up their own committees to also organize, you know, just also provide security, food, some sort of safety and so on. But this was interpreted as insurgency, so it was clamped down real fast. So within this context, Iraq's economy was also dissolved. So 200 government factories, companies were dissolved and privatized. Laws were implemented that allowed foreign investors to come to Iraq and not pay export or import tax. So Iraqis could not compete with global commerce, of course. So this put a lot of people out of jobs. And then, of course, yeah, the human rights abuse, you know, the raids, the murders, the killings, the bombings, the gruesome massacres that you come across if you look back into this. I mean, you must heard of them all, most likely. But like, you know, Americans going inside, raiding someone's house. They talk in loud English. Iraqis don't understand them. This causes miscommunication. They shoot the whole family down. You know, these kind of things. So. Then, you know, in this context, they tried to create a new Iraqi constitution. This happened behind closed doors. It was in a very, quote unquote, undemocratic way. It was written quite hastily, but it was written also in such a way that it's very hard to change the constitution. Like, even if like a post-American Iraq one day will come, and if you stick with this constitution, it becomes very hard to write a new constitution as well. But it's also written in with so much ambiguities, it makes the political process unnecessarily conflictuous. It wasn't seen as fully legitimate. And nonetheless, at the time, I think the Americans wanted to do some sort of indirect voting system. They sort of vote for people who would vote would be in power. This was under immense pressures on the Americans. It was sort of this idea was sort of dropped. So a direct voting system was installed, which created results that were not always favorable to the occupation. So from time to time, a new government had to be selected, or a new prime minister had to be chosen, and so on. Then, of course, you have the how do you say, the sectarian, you know, the way that the way the Orientalist way the United States framed Iraq, you know, as three distinct groups, Sunnis, Shia Kurds, who all hate each other. This was sort of the understanding of Iraqi politics for figures like Bremer and its like. And this forced Iraqis to mobilize and politicize according to their sect, but also because the country was being robbed while everyone was standing, if you know what I mean. So an anxious struggle for resources emerged among Iraq's new elite, and this sort of reproduces sectarian divisions. And add to that, of course, a lot of false flag operations that occurred at the time that were framed as sectarian. And of course, Iraq's neighbors like Saudi Arabia, Jordan at the time, start spreading information, distributing the discourse. We now have a Shia government in power, and the Shias are now deciding what happens in Iraq. This whole discourse mobilized Al-Qaeda and based on that, they recruited supporters in Iraq. And then the car bombing started to happen on a daily basis. Americans generally were unable to sort of stop this. So many people died in this. And afterwards, infighting happened. Yeah.
There's a map of the car bombings and like a digital map. It is the most shocking. Each of those is a missile from the sky. It might as well be.
Yeah.
You know, and to see those little dots, it's unfathomable.
Yeah.
The amount of violence just in that fashion, in that part of the war, in that phase of the war, the violence that it did. I mean, it's crazy. I don't know how to talk about this. Like, I gotta go. We have to stop this conversation because my brain can't handle it.
It's a lot. Yeah. It's not easy to progress this. It's a process. This. It's like I said. It's something many Iraqis, including me, they sort of dread thinking or talking about this. And I got the impression when I was in Iraq, when I talked to people. People are also sort of fatigued from this reality of this occupation, its consequence. So many people are like, yeah, why still talk about it? Why, you know, I understand, like, if we're, you know, abroad, we sort of have the distance to talk about it in a certain way. But in Iraq, until today, there is no, like, there is no memorial. There is no yearly event or anything still taking place. I think the only thing that you sort of have in Iraq is like they made one statue of the shoe that was thrown at Bush.
But then didn't they get mad, the Americans, and do something with it? I can't remember.
I don't.
They weren't happy about it. They were very angry.
I'm not sure what happened to the statue, but I mean, it's sort of. I mean, you all gave it away. It's like the occupation. Invasion is in Iraq still, I think, in highly political sensitive topic, especially because the Americans are still there. So it's like still, my impression is that it is still risky to publicly discuss or reflect on this event in a way that could be understood as some sort of collective reflection on it. So, I mean, there are no statues, there are no commemorations, there are no burial ceremonies or any, like, nothing at all. And this is very peculiar, but this also says, like, about how history is part, and this sounds maybe like self-indulgent as a historian, but history is also, like, how history is remembered is also part of this occupation. The occupation had also a cultural agenda. The occupation also wanted to reformulate Iraqi history in a way to its own favor. And there are several people who have written about this, how there are all kind of like heritage NGOs currently in Iraq, which try now to promote Iraqi heritage, and this is it showed like for like this is very, I don't know, ironic. I don't know if it's ironic or how to call it, but first phase is like destroy Iraqi heritage and then sort of try to promote it again, but through the filtered through Western NGOs and Western museums.
It's a crazy system, isn't it? They blow up your country and then they sell it back to you in the form of Western memorial kitsch, and then they send their children and their little failkinder to come and study you, and they get PhDs and they get jobs, and those children become the people who write policies for the next generation of war crime makers.
There is a thriving vlog subculture on YouTube of Westerners going to you know, like these young millennials, Gen Z, Western kids will go to Iraq and they just flog and they discover Iraq and so on. And it's, you know, I think this is part of that. Like you're talking about the PhDs, but this like on a more, let's say, mainstream level, if you just go on YouTube, there is the amount of vloggers who now from the West who now go to Iraq and you know, enjoy the food and talk about the hospitality and so on. This is part of this rewriting. I mean, Iraqis also see this, especially Iraqis who didn't grow up with this war, who are now sort of young now. We don't remember Saddam. They don't remember the active occupation. They see this. So imagine how they are consuming their own country through social media, through YouTube, through Instagram, through Facebook. And this is another point. Iraq was one of the first countries in the Middle East that had such extensive access to social media, but not the internet. I emphasize social media. Facebook is like one of the most used websites in the country. So Iraqis are subjected to this highly monitored
You got democracy, Amir. Be happy. That's democracy, my friend. That's how we live. I mean, like, you know, it's so funny. When I see Iranians who, like, in their heart want to be, like, accepted by the West, I was like, what do you think is going to change in your life? You're going to be part of this world. Like, you're going to be fed to the machine of the social media companies online, and then you're going to have all the corporations feasting upon you, like, they wanted a rich, like a resource rich, large burgeoning country that they can control, and they could, and it just so happened to be a neighbor to one of their biggest mortal threats, and it benefited them. This is another thing. I mean, we should talk about the insurgency phase, because so much of the reality of the Iraq war stops being narrated at this point that you're discussing. There's the kind of invasion, and then there's the establishment of the occupation, and then they narrate it as, oh, here are a series of governments. I'm not saying you're doing this. You obviously know better than this. But in the sense that part of this is that we had an anti-colonial insurgency. I mean, they call it insurgency, but this is anti-colonial, like, guerrilla warfare. And this went, the campaign that went on for years, and it was an interesting, if not diverse, movement of people from across the country. And there were different varieties of it, because so much of the violence is not part of the invasion of Iraq, but it's in the subsequent...
Military conquest.
They knock... Yeah,
it's
exactly,
one phase. Like the military conquest phase. And afterwards comes the economic, social, cultural, and political dominance. It's a very narrow definition of war, of course, and of occupation. Yeah.
I think they wanted people say, they look back, they say, oh, de-Ba'athification was a disaster. They shouldn't have done that. Oh, disbanding the Iraqi military, they shouldn't have done that. They wanted chaos. This is their goal. Imperialists want countries bogged down in themselves. That's their dream. That's when you're fighting each other, when you're fighting, like, your neighbors, when you're fighting people in other cities. That's the dream of the imperialists, because then they can move in and keep the parts of the country that they like, that they need, aka the oil parts, and they can set up their precious little green zone, which is their colonial fortified zone, which is for surveillance purposes. It's the largest surveillance base in the world, essentially the Green Zone, that it's not this diplomatic or military headquarters. No, it's a nest of spies, just like the U.S. Embassy was, but it takes up a huge chunk of Baghdad, one of the ancient cities of the world. I mean, this is the scale of what we're talking about. And then we're not even going to, we have to somehow, and it, we're already into an hour and a half almost, hour and 10 minutes, we have to somehow get to the 2010s and the insane amount of violence and destruction that was once again dragged. I mean, as if Iraqis hadn't been through enough. They had to go, it was like, what? How many police, like police academy movies are there kind of thing? Like how many times do we have to go through this torture of colonial occupation, invasion, and then occupation, and then a so-called civil war, which is in fact a war brought to you by outsiders, because as we know now, Daesh's support came from outside of the country. Of course, there were people in the country. I mean, we should address that too at some point. There were collaborators and there were Iraqis who were participating, and they do, for whatever reason, right or wrong, they do agree with what you and I, presumably, I'm guessing you probably do, what you and I would see as like insane Gulf propaganda and American imperialist propaganda, as like, oh, she has controlled the country and this and that and what. That like, that they see that, that's the way they see it. Like, I can't, but even then, like, so like the trouble here of the 2010s is like the shattering of the country and then its reconstitution and people fighting over its reconstitution. You know what I mean? Like people fighting over the shards. I mean, this is the dream of the imperialists. And meanwhile, they've taken the gold, they've taken a ton of people, they murdered a ton of people, and they took the oil. They occupied the oil regions, and they broke them off, and they invented, I mean, the KRG is a post-2003, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's a post-2003 invention. Since the 90s. Because it was a no-fly zone.
We forgot about that too. Yeah. They started their occupation in the 90s. Their occupation started in the 90s. It didn't even start in 2000.
Yeah, it was a no-fly zone. Yeah,
and they just branded it as no-fly zone. I mean, I forgot about that part too. Oh my God. Yeah. We're never going to end this episode. We're going to be talking so much, until 2025.
So much. There's so much aspects to this. And one part of it is because it's not, still not really being talked about in an effective and systematic way, I think. They are still, it's like, the way it's been written, it's still not sufficient, I think, to really capture what we are seeing. I mean, the post 2000, I mean, like when we talk about 2010 and beyond, several things we have to talk about here. I mean, first of all, is that the way war would be conducted from then on changes as well. Remote warfare, you know, warfare through drones and
right.
so on.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's true.
So occupation, what occupation is also changed. You know, so it's true that in 2011, the United States officially ended the occupation, but it was also a cost-benefit calculation of how can, you know, given how advanced our technology is, given our the political climate, how can we continue the occupation? And remote warfare started to emerge, partly also because it's more cost effective for the United States. So that's one aspect. And then 2011, 2012, 13, 14 as well, there would be like a jump in oil prices. So there would be lots of oil coming into Iraq at the time as well. And that generates lots of additional conflicts as well. And then you have the Arab Spring, of course, which was created the climate where a group like ISIS could, you know, mobilize in, could be funded, could be, you know, the flow of capital was very important for ISIS. So this needed a certain condition where lots of people could be mobilized and moved and paid in a very short time. So the chaos in the Middle East at the time was very important for this. But I want to also say, like, yes, in addition to the occupation, you now have this in Iraq. But this is also, once again, Iraq is struggling to defend their countries. And I think for a lifetime, this is the first time that Iraqis, and I still remember this, and I still can't believe it, but how some sense of unity was there in Iraq among Iraqis of like diverse backgrounds and groups and even different political on the political spectrum. All of them sort of unified believed ISIS should be out. I think this is not something that was expected. You know, this mass mobilization of Iraqis to sort of fight back against ISIS. And this, of course, entailed additional political politicking, you know, hand-wringing, you know, governments had to change quick. Americans wanted a thing, Russians wanted a thing, and so on. But at the end of the day, struggle or mobilization or the formulation of a new Iraq also, I'd say, emerged in this period. And its legacy.
Isn't that interesting that like a formation defense force, like, because that's essentially what despite all the hater, whatever the haters want to say, that you're talking about the Hashd al-Sha'bi, right? Like the Hashd al-Sha'bi is a defense force, a native defense force of people who are deciding to enforce the sort of national sovereignty or security of a state, or fight for it at least, right? Like, isn't it interesting how the state itself needs a violent mechanism to sort of like constitute itself? I mean, that's basic sort of state theory.
Yeah, yeah. Like this is an old theory, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like it's an interesting thing that you're saying, because I've never heard it from this angle, but it's true, because really, in a sense, is that those the first 5 years of the 2010s are like black flag,
yeah.
Black flag moment for Iraq, our true black flag, because that's. And this was the goal of the U.S., was to create as many of these as possible. And that's what they would have. That's what they were doing in Libya. They created that, mission accomplished. And they were trying to do that in Syria, almost mission accomplished. Failed, actually, by now. But, like, their dream is chaos. Like, the thing that they want, a terror state like ISIS, the thing that they think is like, oh, the reason why we need to fight this war, it's so that a terrorist state doesn't come into existence. No, that's why they fight the wars. That's precisely why.
It's in any case, it justified renewed intervention in Iraq, ISIS. I mean, whatever you sort of believe why ISIS emerged or whatever, at the end of the day, it was used as a way for the United States to come back to Iraq and to reaffirm itself in Iraq. And for, I mean, even, like, let's say, if we just take the most conservative a year that ISIS was defeated, you know, 2017. Years after that, it was still like the reasons that the United States government gave as to why they were still in Iraq, because ISIS, you know, ISIS was defeated, but now it has to be monitored, and the defense has to be, you know, we have momentum now, and so on. But it's not, I think, the additional, like, the mobilization of Iraqis and the meaning of that mobilization afterwards created, I'd say, new political solidarities, new political understandings, but also new contestations, new polarizations. You know, who was the real enemy during ISIS? Was it Saudi Arabia? Was it the Iraqi government? Was it the United States? You know, this you can play with this polarized contestation. You know, especially in a country that is highly sensitive to, you know, disinformation, is very reliant on social media for its internet, for a country that has like hundreds of TV channels. You know, Iraq in a sense is a bit unique in comparison to a lot of countries.
It's interesting. That's, I've never thought of it like that, but it is a kind of, unfortunately, it is this ideological battleground for I guess the sort of various factions in our region, isn't it? Like, because I mean I've seen the Iraqi channels, I can watch them, but like there are many, many, and you can definitely see traces of the sort of shattering of this country across them.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. I didn't think
like
that, but it's true.
It's like all these Saudi Arabia, Dubai, Qatar. Yes, you have several sort of channels that are like supported by Iran, but those are in very few. You have Turkey is also active in the media landscape in Iraq. But also, you know, all these TV channels have their online presence as well. And, you know, they have their talking heads, and it's like an endless feed of information warfare Of course, and it is mostly about, you know, these same topics we're talking about. What is the legacy of the occupation? What is the legacy of the fight against ISIS? Where did ISIS come from? Who is ruling Iraq now? Who must rule Iraq in the future? What is their relation to the... You know, these questions are key, I think, for how Iraq will be in the coming years. And part of this anniversary stuff, part of this media, is also, you know, also part of this. You know, English articles will be translated in Arabic, will be read in English. And also, like, sometimes Arabic news channels, they interview English, you know, academics and journalists and so on as well. So, and then you have, of course, the thousands of panels and think tank events and conferences that will be held this month and the next month that will all sort of feed in this ongoing battle for, you know, what is Iraq? Who are the Iraqis? What happened to, you know, what happened to them? And I think this conversation we're having is also part of this, hopefully. And I think it's good that more of these conversations happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're going into an hour and a half. I feel bad. I must be exhausting you, but I feel like, I guess, I don't know, how do we, because we've kind of narrativized it in these different chunks, right? Of like, there are these phases of the post-2003 era, and then you kind of have to use the 2003 as this kind of like anchor point throughout all of this, because everything kind of becomes up to 2003 and then everything follows from after. But it's, and that's just like a game that, you know, like that we all kind of create in our heads when we talk about stuff. However, I want to know, like how do we get around the problem of like the fact that like people in our part of the world, we don't like seeing ugly images that are real. Like we like action movies, we like spy movies, we like all kinds of violence on TV, porn especially, and like as much as possible, but we need it to be in our heads fictional or in the form of some sort of documentary. However, the like ugliness of the Iraq, of like the crimes against the Iraqi people in just this period, is something that is systematically kept from people. It's kept from like all the images, the worst images from Abu Ghraib were systematically destroyed, and by them, we only saw a fraction of them. And there are still tons of, and even that, there are still tons of images that float around the internet that I've seen, that I'm sure you've seen. I'm sure there's many more from the 2010s. But I think there's one of the huge problems we have in getting people to understand what's at stake when you say things like, oh, so-and-so country wants regime change. Like, you need to show the picture of the U.S. soldier smiling over the Iraqi child whose head has been blown in, whose brains are oozing out of their forehead, and with his brother dead beside him in the car, and some chud from like Iowa is standing there smiling. Like, that needs to be, you need to look at that. You need to be traumatized by that. You need to have that image like burned into your head, because like, or you need to have, or like, this goes back to the original conundrum of like, how do you remember? Because like macro information doesn't help. Like, oh, Iraq, like this, a million people died. Like, what's a million? You know, like, what is a million people? What does that mean? Like, that's so big. And then you're like, oh, okay, then, but here is this individual story of some terrible thing, some terrible atrocity.
Human interest,
American
human
soldier.
Interest story.
Yeah, like, you're in the Anne Frank problem, right? The problem of like, oh, here's one story that stands in for millions, right? Of like, humanizing one life. But all of that is just like this, sitting here and sort of like chewing over this is just like I don't know how to say distraction, but there's an easy way that we can tackle this. We can just sit and look at what happened, and there are like more than enough, and you can do it yourself, and you can just go online and subject yourself to it, and it's not that hard, and there are a ton of documentaries that do it for you and that are prepackaged. But I feel that we are part of a world system, an economic and informational world system. You and I both living in the West, that doesn't allow for that. But it doesn't. People aren't equipped to see what their own supposedly democratic countries do. I don't think so. And so, like, I want to know, like, in your studies, in all of this thing, like, the trauma that you must experience, that, like, that you experience, like, secondhand or firsthand, secondhand, obviously, because you're experiencing from, you're, like, experiencing textually, like, from interviews, from, you know, the sort of academic experience, which is, like, archival or, like, you know, it's mimetic. Mimetic is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
there to yeah. represent it, right? And there is a trauma involved in that. There's absolutely a trauma involved in that. You see this stuff, you know, and most people, like, don't have the time and luxury and comfort that I do to subject themselves to this. They have, like, 9-to-6 jobs. They come home to their kids that they don't see. They're not going to, like, crack open a beer and watch a documentary from Mosul in 2013, 14.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to do that. They're not going to look at, like, TikToks. I mean, this is crazy. I have seen, you know, they make these, like, military, they're called fan cams.
Oh, God.
They're just, like, they're, like, these cuts of, like, U.S. soldiers storming into people's houses with, like, you know, the cliche TikTok music. It's very perverse.
Yeah.
All of this is very perverse. But these are the tiny fragments, the little Polaroids you get here. And that's all you're allowed. But what would you recommend to people? How do you look at the ocean? Like, is what I'm asking. Like, how do you look at it? Do you just face it directly? Or do you, like, go with a guide? Like, do you get a book? Like, you go with a guide, someone takes you? Like, what do you do? What do you do in this ocean of bloodshed and terror?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, this is also traumatizing stuff. And the sort of things that people tell me when I talk to them is, like, truly gruesome stories. Like, how could you have gone this and now casually having an interview with me? This sometimes I ask myself. But what helps me is understanding, like, the wider historical context. I mean, I would like to say that the suffering of Iraqis, while it is to a certain extent exceptionally harsh and gruesome, is also the story of the global South, I'd say. It's also a part of a history of, you know, the haves and the have-nots, and the struggle about that. I mean, this sort of places deeply disturbing events into their wider history. This is not exceptional in the sense of that the past 100, 200, 300 years, colonial violence is part of politics, is part of history. And Iraq presents one aspect of this. So I think the understanding this helps also understanding your own position, but also helps you understand what you're seeing and to what extent its impact is. I'd say. I mean, there are tons of long reads, articles, documentaries that sort of take this, oh, it was a historical event approach, you know, it happened, it was terrible, and then you have some sort of, you know, sentimentality to it. It's very sad, it is very gruesome, it's lots of suffering, but it's also not a historical event. It is still going on. It is still something that is part of daily politics. You know, it's still part of your own world. So understanding this, in my view, helps you, I guess, to a certain extent, not to feel fatalistic. You know, it's only suffering, and then it happened, and then now there is more suffering, I'd say. And I think willing to understand is also very important, rather than to, you know, just to indulge on it. Oh, how bad. Oh, this is really bad. But no, why did it happen? And will it happen again? And what does it mean for understanding other events that will occur? How will the world change, and so on? So you know, this is and despite that, you are only a human being. So if you see suffering, it's on, and you feel terrible about it, I think this is a good sign. I think. No, nobody should, nobody should feel indifferent when seeing something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and the hard part though is that you just don't see it here.
Yeah.
Like, this is the thing. Like, they systematically keep that suffering from you. It's very curated. And its place, they sort of bring, they either ignore it, just straight up blockade it, right? Like,
Yeah, I
to
understand.
this day, like, even things like yesterday, there was an attack on a U.S. oil field in Syria, and nobody reports it. It's not a news. Like, in it would be hard to imagine that your military forces get attacked by another country, by other people, and this doesn't make the news. Like, isn't that interesting? But it's no, because they keep the U.S., like, the U.S. Empire keeps its various chess pieces to itself until they need to make it part of the culture war or
Yeah,
whatever,
of
like
course,
part
of
of the
course.
information sphere. Then that's when they become, oh, let's debate the Iraq war. Oh, let's have it out in the
No,
public intellectual
of
sphere.
course,
Like,
like, I mean, if you just live in the United States, there will be there nothing will come out of the sky and help you understand, oh, the Iraq war is important to know or something like that. No, that won't happen. But I say, like, if you want, I mean, I'd say, like, I mean, the Iraq war is, I'd say, one of the most significant events of the beginning of the 21st century. And, like, if you're a person that wants to understand their position, who has a certain critical faculty about this, you have to see how the war in Iraq was not a war on Iraq. It was a global war meant to globally reassert American hegemony. And to suddenly, to transform other countries. I mean, the entire world was involved in this, and this and had to endure consequences of this war. Seeing like the Iraq War not as a local historical event, but actually part of a global development is key here. So, but if you're asking, like, yeah, they don't want to see it, but people living their lives, some of them are politically aware, some of them are not, and I think even there are even ways to look at the Iraq War without having the correct, let's say, interpretive model to do so. With only, if it only causes a little bit of sentimentality and then you go on with your life, I mean, then it doesn't even impact that very much either, if you know what I mean. It's cynical, but it's, I think it's the truth.
so this is the last question, and I'll release you from this burden. In your travels in Iraq, your recent trip, what were some things that you noted about the future of the country, or what you think the future of the country is like, or just in general, what do you see happening on the ground? I mean, I'm my own question to you, for my own just personal curiosity, is the anti-Iran hysteria as hot as it was, like, say, 3 4 years ago? I was curious about that, what the vibe is there. But in general, what would you say the country's like these days?
Yeah, so when I went, it was during heightened political tensions, I'd say. Like, it was before the results of the elections were agreed upon. And I think there was even an assassination on the president when I was there, actually. But so what I sort of, I went to Iraq, reading, tracking the news and so on. Yeah, you get the impression people, people are polarized, pro-Americans, pro-Iran, and that's what occupies people all day. You go there, people are actually mostly concerned with maintaining their job, staying employed, getting an income, economic struggle, mostly. And there were just some interesting insights. In the city that I was there, in the city that I sort of stayed, I've seen like three, four, or five new restaurants open up, or some sort of shopping mall or something like that. But like roads or plumbage or these kind of, public goods, they are deeply neglected. But if you go to like private commercial, let's say, buildings, like a telecom company or something, like, it's very clean, very ordered. Everything is in a, everything runs perfectly smoothly. But you go to like sort of a public space, it's totally neglected. So, you know, this is like, you know, shows how consumer, you know, consumerism really started to, you know, take root in society as well. But also lots of protesting. I saw lots of protesting. For example, teachers were not getting their salaries. This was like on a weekly basis or something like that. And it was more like this was more about economic concerns. And not really like, oh, why are all my politicians pro-Iranian or something. It's like very much, if you read it from abroad, you really get the idea, oh, people are polarized in this pro-America, pro-Iran group. While it's much more, down to earth and grounded in their direct concerns, which is, I think, normal. I think this is wherever you go. Other than that, I'd say there is a vibrant collective life. I mean, neighbors talk to each other. People help each other. It's like the streets are alive, and so on. But you also see, you know, fatalism, apathy, but also people who just try to get by, and they believe in a brighter future and these kind of things. So, like, I mean, it's a cliche thing to say, but normal things also happen in Iraq.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to end it. And it's good to remember, like, for us, it's like, especially more me, because I'm outside of all this, but it's like, this is the realm of ideas and words and this historical thing and this massacre and, you know, but whereas, like, this is a living country with living people, tens of millions of people who go about their lives and make their lives and struggle. And, you know, so it's important to kind of like situate all of this discussion to this like actual existing place that's going to keep existing and has been existing for a long time and surviving, you know, some, this crazy imperial assault, you know? So thank you, Amir. Thank you for your time. An hour and 40 minutes. My God, I made it's like a mill and I was whipping you and you were graining mill, you were milling something for me. Thank you for milling content.
Thank you. No, I hope, you know, I hope, this is off the record, I hope, but I hope it's like, I hope you found it, you know, insightful. I sort of came to this conversation really not sure what I should talk about, to be honest. So I hope.
No, that's great. It's good. I'm keeping this in the episode because it's very, you're a very humble man.
Thank you.
This was great. I think you walked our way through it. I feel that we're going to have, you know, this is the podcaster producer and me. We're going to have a lot of American centric stories of Iraq sort of dumped on us for like the next 2-3 weeks. And it's going to be like, oh, I was a soldier in that town, dang near town. I got my head blown up. And it's going to be stuff like that. Or it's going to be the sort of, if they're a little bit more responsible, they'll be like, they'll find some rando Iraqi that they can like has some connection to it or whatever. And then it'll just be like, well, it was really bad. There were bombs, you know, like, and because it's the same thing. It's nothing to do with Iraq. It's just, that's how the content machine goes. Like, it's just, okay, what's the next thing? What's the next anniversary we're celebrating? Like, you know, because it's just a machine. So I hope that this episode was edifying for people.
Hopefully,
I really appreciate your time. And I feel like it was. And it's helpful for me, selfishly, I'll say this on mic, but it's helpful for me as I go and I'm about to record like a ton of other content around Iraq and what happened from different perspectives, albeit.
I'm looking forward to those as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to recording those. It's going to be painful like this, but it's good. Pain is good sometimes.
I wish you luck.
It's good. You have to, no pain, no gain sometimes. So I'm going to press stop. Thank you, Amir.